little slower.
Morning, members. I'll call to order the Senate Jobs and Economic Growth Committee. I know we have several members who are going to be in and out this morning, but I think we'll be able to do most of the work, if not all the work, on Senator Lilly's bill. So, Senator Lilly, are you in the room? There you are. You want to slowly make your way down to the far table, and we'll tee this up for you.
Yes.
So, members, this is, I guess you could say this is bill number two that we've talked about in the last couple weeks on regulatory relief. The last one, you'll recall, was Senator Daley's that talked about putting together a structure to roll back or and even delete old and obsolete rules. This one is more immediate and talks about a moratorium, calls for a moratorium I think Senator Lilly has also used the word a timeout, just a timeout on new rules or new mandates that job creators have to live with. So that is Senate File 1631. We've got a number of people who want to testify. Can I also just announce for those in the room, if you aren't on our list, if you could come up to kind of this corner of the table and then give us your name, and we'll make sure we should have plenty of time to take testimony this morning. And I'll also note, Senator Lilly, that your bill, I think, is about a page. But the fiscal note is 28 pages.
Yes, it is.
That might be a new record as far as the ratio. So, Senator Lilly, thank you for carrying this legislation. Welcome to the committee this morning. The floor is yours.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. Yes, one of the most common complaints that we have heard as we were traveling around the state this summer and as many of us have talked to our business community and to our chambers of commerce is that government keeps changing the rules, that businesses do not have a clear definition of what the rules are that they're doing business under, and that this is limiting their ability to grow jobs in the state of Minnesota. So what we're looking for is, what the job creators are really looking for, is a timeout, a chance to hold the line on new rules and new regulations from all aspects of government. We need to provide job creators with a certainty, with a certain clarity that they know what rules they're going to be doing business under so that they can free up their capital and start hiring more people in the state of Minnesota. Senate File 1631, which we will be going through an amendment in just a moment, provides for a two-year moratorium for all agencies given rulemaking authority. And actually, could I move that amendment right
Senator Lilly
now?
And members, let me make sure that everyone has a copy. So Senator Lilly is going to offer the A2.
A2.
You're going to offer the A2. Let's just make sure everyone has that first. And members, I will note that there is a quorum present. So we're handing out the A2 right now. Why don't you give us a few seconds, Senator Lilly, just to make sure everyone has that. So, members, this is in the form of an author's amendment, so let's get it into the format that let's get the bill into the format that the author would like. So, Senator Lilly moves the A2. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion passed. The A2 is adopted. So, Senator Lilly to the A2.
All right, Mr. Chair.
And the rest of the bill.
Thank you. So Senate File 1631, as it is amended, is basically a two-year moratorium on all agencies that are given rulemaking authority by the legislature. And in this rulemaking, we did want to pay attention to the needs as we go forward and have some adaptability for the agencies. So there are five exemptions that are in this legislation. They include exemptions for federal law, for a declared state of emergency, for emergencies relating to public health or safety, and also for rules enacted by this legislature, and to facilitate commerce. These are common sense exemptions that are needed and necessary in order to allow the agencies to continue to move forward with important rules and yet at the same time provide that clarity that we are looking for as a business community. And this bill truly will send an instant message to our job creators that we are serious about making Minnesota the best state in which to do business, invest their capital, and create jobs. So what I'd like to do at this time is to introduce Eric Littman. Eric is a judge in the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I'd like to ask him to talk about the rulemaking authority that the legislature and the agencies have with each other.
Thank you, Senator Lilly. Mr. Lippman, nice to see you. Welcome to the committee.
Chairman Michelle, members, my name is Eric Lippman. I'm the Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge with the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. And in that capacity, I'm the head of the Administrative Law Division. And Senator Lilly has asked me to do a two-minute tutorial about rulemaking because while this is a business jobs bill, it does have some, obviously, features relating to rulemaking. So there are two key ideas this morning. The first is, how is it that the legislature can and frequently does impose conditions on agency rulemaking authority? And the second, are the conditions that Senator Lilly proposes in 1631 the right conditions? Okay. So I'll deal with the first question because...
Mr. Chair, I believe that the members do have a packet or have information in their packets. Just wanted to make sure that they had those available.
Thank you,
available.
Okay.
Thank you.
And because judges of the Office of Administrative Hearings, so as to maintain our independence, never take policy positions on particular legislation, I'm going to be confining my remarks to the first question, which is, how is it that the legislature does make conditions? Senator Lilly, in advocating his bill, will talk about, will at least assert that these are the right conditions to impose. Okay? So the handout I'll be working from in the next 2 minutes is Jefferson's delegation boxes. Because I want to... working from the left-hand side here, I want to recall your 7th grade civics class and Thomas Jefferson. As you'll remember, he wrote that men are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and that to secure those rights, governments are instituted amongst men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So that's the idea of the first box. The same idea is found in the very first clause of the Minnesota State Constitution. Governments are instituted for the security, benefit, and protection of the people, in whom all political power is inherent, together with the right to alter, modify, or reform government when required by the public good. So the idea here is, if we're going to put little pictures to that those ideas, God makes the delegation to the voters, gives them all in whom all political power is inherent, if we were to take the text out of our state constitution, and then the voters lend their power to members of the legislature on 2- and 4-year cycles. And they condition their lawmaking power, which they've been given to by God, at least that's what's suggested by the state constitution and the federal constitution, to you, and they condition it in certain ways as provided in the state constitution. It has to be a majority vote, tax bills start in the House, has to be presentment to the governor, there's certain override situations. It's not the legislature does enact laws in any way that it sees fit. There's been a conditioning of the power given from the voters to you, okay? And we do that in the state constitution. Similarly, and what we're talking about here today, is there's a further delegation. Your lawmaking power that you've been given is given to executive branch agencies to promulgate new laws, otherwise known as administrative rules. When they're properly promulgated, they're just as enforceable and have just the same effect as if it was a statute passed here. Okay? So there's been a delegation of lawmaking power to an executive branch official. Okay? And so there's also, in that process, a set of conditions that go with that lawmaking power for an executive branch official to enact a new rule, to promulgate a new rule, to create a new law. And those conditions are found in Chapter 14. Okay? So God gives to voters. There's no restrictions. Voters give to you under the Constitution. You give to state agencies under Chapter 14. Okay? Why do you condition the lawmaking power under Chapter 14? Well, I describe this as Office Space A and Office Space B. And I'm sorry, I should have had a picture of the Senate. As a former House member, I guess I default to the other body, but no disrespect is intended.
Thank you, Professor Lippman.
But if you look at Office Space A, it's very open, it's transparent. Those people were who sit at those desks were selected in a public process. They're on the ballot. They have election certificates. Their proceedings are televised on TV. It's open and transparent. So when the folks in Office Space A do lawmaking, they've been selected by the voters, and it's an open and transparent process. When rules are promulgated, the folks who are writing those rules and who are adopting orders, issuing those rules, are frequently appointed officials. They're not selected by the voters. They're probably not known to many of the voters, the people who are writing and adopting those rules. They don't necessarily have to do all of their work in public. Much of it is done in public, and that's one of the conditions. But it's a less transparent process than perhaps a statute enacted by the legislature in open session. Okay? And so among the conditions, that's the last piece, that the legislature imposes in Chapter 14 on executive branch officials in order to promulgate a new rule is there's a public notice process. They publish in the State Register, and they have to go out and find folks who might well be interested in a particular rule and let them know, hey, we're doing rulemaking. They have to set out what they're going to do and address a number of important factors in a statement of need and reasonableness. That's what it means by the SONAR. They actually have to prove up the reasons why they're doing it with an affirmative presentation of facts. They can't just say, we like this rule and we say so because we like it. They actually have to show a reason why. There's an independent review by our office. There are independent judges that look over that work before. Again, we don't just take the agency's word for it. There's a searching review by folks who are not paid by the agency in an employee sense. And then there's also a final check is the gubernatorial review, the review that Governor Dayton and his team does, and potentially the threat of a veto, which is we're not going to let that rule go forward. And so there are a series of checks on state agencies promulgating and adding to the range of administrative rules by all of these processes. Do it in the public, prove it up, make sure that there's independent people who are looking over to check your work, and indeed a final political check with the governor. And so with that, we're glad to stand for any questions about Chapter 14.
Sarah Lilly, thank you. I want to say Professor Lippman, because I think this was really helpful and just kind of give us the big picture. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, just in a matter of clarification, my understanding is that this committee's role is to look at the job creation aspect of this legislation. And Judge Lippman has previously given this same presentation to the State Government Committee. But I felt that it was important, since we're talking about rulemaking, it's not the purview of this committee to really go into detail about the rulemaking as much as it is about the jobs. But I felt that it was important that we had a baseline understanding of the process that OAH goes through and that we go through. And this bill will be continuing on, should we pass it, to the State Government Committee, and we will go into more depth with the rulemaking process there. But I felt that it was important to have a baseline understanding of this process that is in place for all of our members.
Absolutely.
Chairman.
I have Senator Daley.
I'm home.
Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Lilly, for bringing this forward. I think this is a good measure. It moves us in the right direction. When I've heard from business owners in my home community of Eagan and Burnsville, there are four things that they typically talk about. They talk about the tax structure and need for tax reform. They talk about regulations and permitting processes. They talk about the challenges of health care and health care costs and energy costs. So this fits right in with what I see as number two, the regulations, permitting process challenges. And the word that comes to their mind first and foremost is uncertainty. Uncertainty is not something that is helpful for them and their business planning and processes. And if we can reduce some of that uncertainty, I think that is a very good thing for our business owners as they do planning. And this measure helps move us in that direction. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I have. I think this is a good idea. Thanks for bringing it forward. But this last box, the rulemaking, Chapter 14, I've always kind of preached that what you do as a legislature is say what you mean in a bill. So you don't have to give it the next step to the rulemaking authority. I've been saying that for years. And tell us exactly what you mean in here in the law. So you guys, the department folks, make an apple become a banana. It's not what I meant when I did the bill, you see. So that's my point. But this is all right. Thank you. But say what you mean as legislators in your legislation so the rulemaking folks don't have to look at it. Okay?
That's well said, Senator Metzen. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, and I don't know if this is for Senator Lilly or for staff, but yesterday Senator Nelson had a rulemaking bill in education, and we have set in statute a series of dates and deadlines for the Commissioner of Education to review our state education standards. So I'm just wondering if this applies to every rule or if it just applies to specific rules, if it just applies to business rules. Is there something in here that says which specific rules this applies to?
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, it would apply to most rules that are passed by the different agencies, to most rules. Again, if we look at the exemptions from that process, legislative is one of the categories that allows for the exceptions to go forward. So that is something that would continue.
But what do you mean by that exactly?
Okay, on line in the amended format. Let's
see, number three.
1.14.
So three and
numbers 3 and 4, line 1.14, 1.15. Section number 3 there, relating to incorporation of specific changes set forth in statute, would refer to legislative action. So legislative action would allow for those types of changes to continue to happen.
So Mr. Chairman,
Senator Tomasoni,
let me get more specific then, because I'm not trying to oppose this. I'm just trying to understand it.
Yes.
So in the case of the education revising of the education standards, there is a statute that says in 2010 and 2011, and Senator Nelson can help me on this if I get it wrong, the commissioner shall look at the social studies standards and decide whether they should change them or not. Since that is a specific legislative mandate to the rulemaking authority of the education department, is that an exception under this particular intent here?
Senator Lilly, and I'm also looking at Senator Nelson too, if she wants to chime in.
And I don't know, maybe staff can help too on this. I'm not sure what. I mean, I understand what you're trying to do, but it might be a broader brush than you want to make, and I'm not sure if that's.
Yes. Mr. Chair,
Senator Lilly,
Senator Tomasoni, again in that line 1.14, relating to incorporation of specific changes set forth in statute. So in this case, that is specifically set forth, would be my understanding, so that would still be allowed. That would be my reading of that.
Senator Nelson.
I'll just I don't necessarily want to drag the whole Jobs Committee into the Education Committee.
We're ready.
Okay, all right. Well, we know that education is important for jobs. We know we've got a job skills gap. Two things. In my understanding of Senator Lilly's bill, because of things that are already in statute, would continue on, is as I understand his bill, but he can speak to that better. But the one piece I did want to speak to in that regard is Judge Lippman's explanation of the transparency process. And when it comes to something as important as standards for our kids, obviously the public is much more well-served and invested having that very transparent process as opposed to rulemaking. So I just wanted to make the distinction between the transparency in the elected body and the not as much transparency in the rulemaking body.
I just have to follow up because I don't think I got my question answered.
And Senator Thompson, can I suggest that we have Senate Counsel put something else on the record to your question?
And let me ask Senate Counsel also this, because if it's I don't know, maybe I'm missing something, but it seems to me that we always give rulemaking authority in order for rules to be made. So all rules that are being promulgated are as a result of a legislative statute or a legislative, isn't that correct? I mean, nobody makes rules unless we tell them to. So my question is, which rules are we trying to delay or not re-promulgate? Okay.
Well stated. Okay. Council.
Mr. Chair and members and Senator Tomasoni, the legislature grants very broad authority on broad topics, and so in that sense, the legislature sometimes comes back and wants a specific rule, and I think that is what this is addressing in the amendment, and the general authority to promulgate rules, that is what is being dialed back, I think, just to promulgate new rules on whatever the broad topic is. But if it's specific in a statute saying you need to conduct rulemaking or review this and amend rules accordingly, I believe under this amendment that is what would be encompassed. Otherwise, rulemaking should cease for this period of this temporary moratorium. And also I would ask if Judge Lippman has something more to add to that, because I was uncertain whether something that was already in statute that was perhaps not passed by this majority would be necessarily something that would want to be continued. And I would like his thoughts on that.
Judge Lippman, on this, on Senator Tomasoni's kind of general points and questions.
So Chairman Michelle, Senator Tomasoni, as I'm reading the A2 amendment, that if a delegation of rulemaking authority and rulemaking was undertaken by an agency but not complete by July 1, 2012, and let us say that for the purposes of this hypothetical, it's your example, the Education Committee has passed a bill saying go forth and promulgate social studies standards. Okay, the Commissioner of Education should do this, or the Board of Teaching or whomever is given the instruction to promulgate the new standards. If the social studies standards were selected, let's say the A2 is current law. If the social studies standards were selected by the legislature, you'll have, know about this kind of geography, you'll do these kinds of exercises, you'll show proficiencies in this way, and that the Commissioner of Education is to promulgate a rule that says that would be within the good cause exemption because the policy choice had been made by the legislature. Under your example, where it's go and figure out what's a useful thing for kids to know about social studies and promulgate that in a rule, that would be subject to the 2-year suspension. And so if the policy choice has not been specifically made relating to incorporation of specific changes set forth in the statute, then that would be something that would be subject to the timeout. What we do as OEH judges is when there is a bit of rulemaking done through the good cause exemption, we take out a copy of the proposed rule and we compare it to the statute, and if there are other things that are in the proposed rule that are not in the statute, it gets a defect and it doesn't go forward under this process, the good cause exemption. And what I understood Senator Lilly to do in the A2 amendment is to have the good cause exemption process, the 4 exceptions there, and also to have the obsolete rule process be the only exceptions to the 2-year timeout.
All right, so I want to, Senator Thompson, stay on this line of questioning, and I think we're going to get some more testimony that might tease it out some more. I've got Senator Torres-Ray and then Senator Dziedzic. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a problem per se with this language, Senator Lilly, because I think 2-year moratorium is a kind of a good time for us to look into how this process, kind of works or doesn't. I am kind of more concerned about the fundamental premises behind these changes in terms of, promoting constitutional amendments, step into the role of commissioners like we did yesterday in education, and today stepping into interfering with the rulemaking process. I happen to think that the rulemaking process is a very complex one, and I agree with the testifier in terms of really how much we need to dive into comprehending how this process works and how extensive it could be. I participated in the creation of a rule called the Umbrella Rule for Juvenile Justice and Foster Care, and it took 4 years. I think that's ridiculous, and part of it had to do with the fact that multiple agencies had multiple policies in place governing out-of-home placement and juvenile justice. And as a result of it, we had to create a method, you know, for placing kids in juvenile facilities, out-of-home care. So I learned through that process that rulemaking is a very complex issue, but we make it even more complex. So I agree with that notion. What I disagree with is this approach of, we're not going to do it then. And I want to hear, you know, about the consequences of not doing this for 2 years. I want to hear about the consequences for, you know, what is in kind of in the oven right now that we need to bake. And it's not going to get baked because we are interfering with this. What are the issues behind, you know, why do we have this process in place? Why do we have, you know, a rulemaking process in place to really clarify some issues that clearly we're not able to put here in three paragraphs? That's the fundamental value. Those are foundations of our democracy. If we want to change this with three, you know, I'm so glad that you did an amendment, but, you know, your original language is just so emphatic. We dealt with this yesterday in education. Emphatic. This is not going to happen because we say so. And I have a problem with that, Senator Lilly. I have a problem with coming here and say, this is not going to happen because I just don't like this process. I would like to hear more. This whole thing, we're going to step in into, you know, working on curriculums because we don't trust the process that has been in place for many, many, many years. And we just don't like it. So we're going to change it. We're going to step in and we're going to do it differently. I think that is wrong, and I think that is arrogant, and I think we need to think about what we're doing here. I would like to know more. And again, Senator Lilly, the 2 years, really I don't have a problem. You know, I like to learn, but it's really what is behind this. So we step in and we say, these processes with the executive, they no longer work. You know, you might not be here ruling in 2012. 2013. So is it a ruling party effort here? I'm sorry, Senator, but I just do have a problem with that.
Thank you, Senator Torres Rey.
I got to point out, Senator Lilly's probably about the least arrogant member of our state Senate body, so I know you didn't mean it in that fashion, but, you know, maybe in general as this discussion continues, the way I'm looking at this, Senator Lilly, is that This puts into place the timeout, and we believe we need a timeout because of the additional rules, mandates, regulations, and not just from our level of government, but from other levels of government that are coming down, that are raining down on our businesses and job creators, and that this kind of a timeout can be helpful as we're in the midst or even the end of a recession, helpful to them so that instead of spending time on lawyers and compliance, they can spend more time on investment and creating jobs. So that's kind of the general policy direction that you're moving here. And then if you look at lines, you know, basically lines 111 through 117, that's what I'd call the off-ramp. So that's where much of this process, Senator Torres Rey, can continue. There are life, health, safety, and other issues that we'll need to we will still need to have rulemaking. And indeed, I think we'll hear some testimony that there is some rulemaking that can actually be helpful to job creation. So I think Senator Lilly's tried to fine-tune this pretty well, and we'll take some more testimony. Senator Lilly, I don't know if you had a comment specifically to Senator Torres Rey, and then I have Senator Dziedzic and Senator DeKreif next.
If I could quickly, Mr. Chair, and Senator Torres Rey, first off, I think the process that we're going through is as you mentioned, emphatic. Actually, we're trying to listen. We're trying to find a way to offer to the job creators this opportunity to have the clarity that we spoke about, that I spoke about in the beginning, so that we can put more people back to work. At the same time, we need to understand how this impacts our agencies, how going forward, and what those impacts are. And we actually will hear from a couple of commissioners about those impacts. So we will have that opportunity to answer your questions more directly in a few moments. The point about stepping into this, actually, as Judge Lippman shared, we're not really stepping into this. We're actually taking accountability for something that is our responsibility. We are the ones that hand off the ability to make rules. It's the legislative body's responsibility to do this and to evaluate how far do we hand it off and to what level do we hand that off. So this is part of our responsibility to do this moving forward. And Judge Lippman shared some information about that right at the beginning of the conversation today. As far as the consequences, I think that there may be consequences, and I think that the off-ramps that are here offer us the ability to deal with those consequences when they are important consequences to allow that rulemaking to continue, and yet at the same time allow the business community to have that clarity, that vision to go forward so that they can invest and put more people back to work. So we are trying to find that balance, and it isn't a one party versus another party. It's all let's work together to try to put people back to work in Minnesota. That's what I'm trying to achieve.
Okay, so let's roll to Senator Dietzick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Some of this might go to the council, as I'm kind of following up on what Senator Tomasoni said on just what gets in there and what doesn't. And I don't have Section 14388 in front of me, and I don't see in here to facilitate commerce. So is that in that chapter? And so, like on page the MPCA section, it talks about item number 3, so it is page 10. Item number 3, to facilitate commerce, and it talks about stuff. So would that still be in, as you say, the off-ramp? And then again on page 17, the fire codes, and so that, I mean, again, and I would say this would be facilitating commerce, and so again, it's having unintended consequences. So like this delay could further reduce the construction industry's ability to implement cost-saving technologies, which I don't think is Senator Zilley's purpose. It's, I mean, again, that would be an adverse consequence that we don't want to, you know, by accident happen. And so I'm wondering, does that fit into one of those off-ramp?
Mr. Chair and members and Senator Dietzick, that the to facilitate commerce is no longer included in this amendment. But, again, I think under the relating to incorporation of specific changes set forth in statute, I would imagine that an agency could certainly come to the legislature and ask for a statute or some sort of law authorizing rulemaking on some of these specific topics.
And Judge Lippman, to that question?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dietzick, yes, I think exemption number 3, if the specific policy choice was made by the legislature and the instruction given to a state agency to adopt that rule, that would be an exception. So in the example of either the social studies standards or a matter to facilitate commerce, if the policy choice were made here and the text written out, you could give instruction to an agency to do that, and that would be one of these good cause exemptions.
Senator DeCryf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lilly, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. Actually, I have something of a question for you. I actually had a friend call me, somebody that I've known for years. He's been in business for 25 years, and apparently some new rules that went into effect this year from MPCA could jeopardize about 40 businesses in Minnesota. And the new licensing requirements of these businesses, and quite frankly, it's in his opinion, there would only be about 4 manufacturers left in Minnesota that manufacture the same product he does. And he's very alarmed by this because if this happens, it will greatly increase costs to the consumers, and it will put a lot of people out of business. And in here, on page 10, as Senator Dziek mentioned, MPCA apparently feels that these rules aren't going to affect them.
Senator Kreifler, just an interruption. So you're looking at page 10 of the fiscal note.
Of the fiscal note.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Senator Kreifler.
It says currently active rulemaking would not be affected by the proposed moratorium. And I have some concerns with that. Actually, I think we're going to have to take a different avenue to help out the businesses that I'm talking about, because these rules are already in place and they're trying to activate them this year. So we might have to go a different avenue. But is this true in your opinion that MPCA would not fall under this moratorium at all?
Of course.
Senator Lilly or Mr. Lippman or both?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator, I think that the fiscal note, as I understand these pages, and our agency also filled out a fiscal note. You'll see the OAH's description in this packet, was priced to 1361 as introduced. That answer might well change, and if there's somebody from the PCA, they could certainly talk about that as to whether all of their rulemaking would go forward if it were only good cause exemption or repealing obsolete rules, which is what the A2 amendment says.
And members, just for a little more background, so it's always nice to get a fiscal note and all the information that comes with it, and we got it last night. So for Senator Lilly and staff who've been working on this, this is a document that's about 12 hours old, so we're digesting pieces of it too. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kreif, Judge Lippman, actually, if I could ask the question slightly differently for Senator DeKreif. So as this is now stated, as the amendment is now stated, would what is stated here, it's actually on page 9 of the fiscal note, under assumptions, that the MPCA is saying that due to the three off-ramps, so to speak, necessary to implement federal law, authorized by the legislature, or necessary to facilitate commerce, would most rulemaking in the MPCA be exempted if you were to rule on that rulemaking?
Mr. Chairman, members, the question is, I don't know. Clearly, the first two assumptions carry forward into the A2 amendment. Necessary to implement federal law or specifically authorized by the legislature. I don't know how broad for the MPCA, they would have to speak to that, is that third category necessary to facilitate commerce. One could imagine that that an agency would regard everything that it's done as useful for commerce. You know, it could be a very small category, it could be a very large category. I don't know sitting here today how big that category is, and they would have to speak to that.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Your Honor, social studies standards, now that you brought that up, brings me to another point on this. In 2003, we passed legislation that said that the Department of Education would promulgate rules in regards to the standards of education, and specifically said that the rulemaking had to come back to the legislature for approval, in which case we got into a great big discussion about whether or not the rules were right and how they should be changed, and et cetera, and then it was passed by the legislature. The current law now says that the Commissioner of Education shall revise the rules. And so I'm not sure if the first one then applies to the second one, so that this becomes an exception to this rule. But, and I don't need your response to it, but I think it's just an indication of what the complications could possibly be. But there's two things that I have to ask questions about. Number one is, can you explain the change from the original bill? This line 1.16, this section does not prohibit an agency from repealing rules to the 1.17 in the delete everything, the process for repealing obsolete rules in Minnesota statute section 14.3. It looks like we went from repealing rules to repealing obsolete rules. And boy, some of us think there's some obsolete rules like the wild rice standard that should be repealed. But But I want to make sure you're not limiting us from repealing at number one. And okay, well, so
Tom, so let's take that one in order, okay?
Right,
so
another amendment?
I know you're,
it might be.
You and Senator Daley are working on those obsolete rules, but, yeah. But maybe if I could ask counsel then on so Senator Tomasoni's question comparing the original bill to the A2.
Yes.
And the intent behind the amendment and how it's covered.
Mr. Chair, members, and Senator Tomasoni, the intent is the same, to be able to repeal rules. And again, I think the legislature can decide to what is no longer necessary, and then therefore it would be obsolete. So perhaps the legislature would need to sort of step in and say what's no longer necessary, and then that would make it obsolete. That would be my interpretation of that.
So that changes it from the rulemaking agency to repealing the rule to the legislature repealing the rule. Is that what you're saying?
No, well, Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I think that there perhaps are rules that are obsolete on their face, that are a program that's no longer being funded or is no longer being utilized, and that on its face is obsolete. And then maybe there is something that's the will of the legislature to make it obsolete, and they would pass a law.
So does the rulemaking agency have the ability to repeal rules?
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, yes, I believe they do. I don't have the Chapter 14 in front of me, and perhaps Judge Lipman could speak a little more specifically to that.
Judge Lipman, to that.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, what the A2 amendment does is link up with current law. Under current law, executive branch agencies are obliged to review their rules. They file a report on December 1 of each year about those rules that they regard as no longer appropriate or obsolete. There is a public notice process, which is they check in with people. We're thinking about repealing this rule, but there's an expedited process for getting rid of things that are not not appropriate. For those things that the legislature thinks are not appropriate, apart from what the agencies might well think, the paragraph directing a specific change would still be an option for you. Repeal this rule. And so you would send that direction to the agencies. They would come through the exempt process saying, they told us to do it, and here it is, and we would do the exempt process for that.
Okay, so we really didn't change anything from one to the other.
Well, I think the A2 amendment links up with, rather than describing it functionally, links it up with things that are in the current statute.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chairman, you said something that I thought was important, and you said something about we might want to make rules that are helpful. And does this law stop us from making rules that are helpful?
Counsel.
No, Mr. Chair, members, and Senator Tomasoni. I think the A2 amendment on line, on paragraph 3, 1.14, if the legislature has an idea that they believe will facilitate commerce or create jobs, then they can pass a law that requires a rulemaking.
Okay, I've got Senator Kielash and Senator Nelson, and then I do want to get to some more testimony members, so let's keep rolling here. Senator Kielash.
Yeah, Judge, I'm a little concerned. I think there's a certain amount of ambiguity in this that means such as, you know, your obsolete law may not be my obsolete law, for starters. You know, things like serious and immediate threat to the public. Well, if you took asbestos, it's a long-term threat. Does that mean we can't stop, you know, any kind of contamination, those kinds of issues? And the other thing is that you mentioned if the legislature sets a policy. So if the legislature charges the PCA with keeping our water clean, just because it's I'm using that as an example. It may not be the best example, but you know, is that enough authority for them to say we're going to make rules? Or the DNR says we're responsible for fishing and hunting, and if they decide to create a rule for a specific lake to protect that lake, is that I mean, does all of that have to come back to the legislature and specifically say you can make that rule?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, let me take the second question first. I think the A2 amendment contemplates that if you have a broad delegation of rulemaking authority, keep our waters clean, mm-hmm. manage our state lands and the fish and game that might well be on that, those broad types of things would have a two-year timeout under the A2 amendment. If there was a specific policy choice, you have to regulate the gray wolf in X way and do it in Y time frame, and here is the policy choice, go forth and promulgate that rule, put that in the DNR's regular rules, that I think would be narrow enough to qualify under exemption number 3. What we would do at OAH is compare your statute or your chapter law, the instruction mm-hmm. from the legislature, with the rule that's promulgated, and there really has to be a near perfect match. If there isn't, that doesn't qualify under exempt rulemaking. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a narrow exception. As to the nature of obsolete rules, the 14.3895 process suggests that the agency will make the first cut at what it thinks are obsolete. If you have a different view and are able to convince a majority of members in this body and the other body, and also the governor, it's your delegation. You're the one driving this train, and so that was why I started out with the various boxes. The delegation comes from the voters to you first, and you can condition in pretty much any way that's constitutional your delegation to the agency. So if you have a different view about what's obsolete, you're driving this train.
Just to follow up,
One
of my concerns is how does this change a procedure for an agency that wants to that thinks it's under the exceptions to move forward? Do they say this is an exception and therefore whatever, and we have to go to your office or to the judges to get a ruling on this before we can move forward? Do we have? I mean, how does the process change under this law?
Mr. Lipp.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, if there's a delegation of authority to enact a particular rule and they think they qualify in one of these exceptions, they would file those materials with our office. There'd be a legal review of our office. If we rule against them, there's a defect. There is an appeal process by which they can, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not the final word of it, but if we don't, if those rules are not approved for legality, they will not go forward. If we find a defect that they don't qualify under this exemption, they don't go forward unless that decision is later overturned through the appeal process.
Yeah, one more follow-up, and that is what's kind of the number of cases for rulemaking that you're currently doing, and what would you expect to see if this were to pass?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, with regret, I don't have broad numbers, but what we did do some rough calculations yesterday, and the things that would survive in the A2 amendment, exempt rulemaking and obsolete rulemaking, would be about 5% of the legal reviews that we're doing today. And so I think you can think of 95% as being ordinary rulemaking under Chapter 14, whether it is with or without a hearing, and that would be subject to the two-year timeout. So it would be a narrow band that would be permitted. Now maybe it becomes a larger band if there's lots of use of exemption number 3. But if the current ways that in fiscal 10 and 11 were to carry forward during the moratorium period, we would have a 95% timeout. I hope that's
I guess I didn't get what I didn't get is what would the change be? The numbers change be or what anticipated? So if you're doing 5% now with this change, would that be more or less? I guess
I'm I couldn't imagine, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, I can imagine a scenario where there would be lots of use of relating to the incorporation of specific changes. If there was a moratorium period, agencies might well say, this is really important. We were going to do this through regular rulemaking, but because of the moratorium, we want you to make the specific policy change. You're going to write it up, you're going to debate it, and pass it and direct us to put it into the rules during the moratorium period. So I could imagine a scenario where that number 3 would be used more often during the moratorium than it has been in the two prior or three prior or regular history of exempt a good cause exemption rulemaking.
What I want to do now is have Senator Nelson
She asked to be recognized. And I also want to encourage Senator Nelson, could you maybe introduce the next witness we want to have at the table? These guys are staying with us.
Before the judge goes up.
He's staying. He's staying.
Yeah, sure. No, I was just going to get out of the way.
But and also remind members, there's no way to avoid kind of the state government jurisdiction and some of the rulemaking procedural discussion, and we're not trying to. But rest assured, this legislation is going to get combed over again before that committee, and so Senator Lilly's going to have some more work to do. But Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chairman Michel and members. Some of my comments have already been made, so I don't need to remake those. But I will say that I would like to note that Jerry Zube, who will be testifying, is a Rochester businessman, well-known businessman, and it's just kind of interesting how the timing is all played out on this. I had asked Jerry to keep a list for me of all of the rules and regs that have negatively impacted his business. We just started visiting about this in January. So I'm hoping that today we'll get to hear some of those specifics and that Senator Lilly's bill is trying to address.
So, Zube?
Yes.
Mr. Zube, welcome to the committee, and appreciate your testimony this morning.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate the invite. I forgot how beautiful this building is. I think, embarrassingly, the last time I was here was in my eighth grade field trip, so I don't do this a lot.
Well, it hasn't changed much since then, has it? Mr. Zube.
As an introduction to myself, I started washing dishes in Rochester when I was 15 years old, mainly because nobody would hire me when I was 14. This is my 40th year doing this. I've owned and operated 16 restaurants, 13 of which I built, two from the ground up. I had a seafood market, which we did wholesale and retail, especially food market. I've managed two other restaurants. I've done consulting to some restaurants, including Walt Disney World, which is a real rush. We'll get into that some other day. That was great. So far, though, I'd say that my specialty is still in washing dishes, and I'm getting really good at it, and I enjoy it, and that's my passion. Full disclosure here, I am I'm a capitalist. I believe in personal freedoms and personal responsibilities. I believe that in our country, in our Constitution, in the founding, I believe that small businesses in particular are the best way to grow. I believe me standing in my dining room with customers on one side and staff on the other is the best way to make a decision as to how I can expand my business and thrive and hire more people and keep on going. The purpose of this meeting, I'm not sure really how this is involved with the bill. Honestly, I didn't even understand really the conversation we just had. I will defer to the sharper minds ahead of me to figure out this mishmash and how it all works. The reason I'm in the restaurant business is because I'm too dumb to do anything else. But over the years, I have had the opportunity, we'll say, to interact with an army of bureaucrats and bureaucracies, and I got to say, it is just stifling out there. We have building and safety. Start off with the electrical inspector, who I lovingly refer to as His Majesty, and all the other trades know who I'm talking about when I say that. Plumbing department, mechanical, which is heating, ventilating, air conditioning, in the restaurant business, the hoods, the makeup air, and the like. Fire department, ADA, weights and measures, sales tax department, liquor inspector, Department of Public Safety, and our beloved health department as well. Restaurants, we interact with a ton of different agencies because we have so many different things going on. I think the only rules I don't fall into are things that deal with tires and nuclear waste. Otherwise, I'm doing something with everyone. Every one of these agencies is an impediment to business. Some of them are bumps in the road. Some of them are brick walls. But none of them help things out. They give seemingly practical reasons as to why they exist and what they're trying to do. And it all sounds lovely. And I'm sure buried in there somewhere is a great idea. But, oh, man, sometimes things just get really out of whack. Start off, I'll tell you about my parking lot, which I'm in a strip shopping center, and the parking lot entrance is the dumbest design on the planet. I don't know who came up with it. It wasn't me. It was before I got there. I have many, many customers that are frustrated daily telling me that they don't shop at my place because they can't get in. There's plenty of cars on the street, and I'm standing inside with plenty of empty tables, but we can't seem to do business. I've tried to rearrange the entrance to the parking lot, but city, county, DOT, pick an agency, gives me all the reasons why you can't do it. I thought something simple, like time the stoplights out there to let the parking lot on my end clear out. You know, everybody gets off the elevator before anybody else can get on the elevator. Well, they plug all the numbers into their computer, and the answer comes out the other side, no, all right? We thought maybe we'd get a little escape hatch on one side so that at least the people trapped inside don't have to go through this stupid intersection. We could have another one down the road a ways. They plug the numbers in their computer. The answer comes out no, because it's too close to the other intersection. Two blocks to the north, I can point to an identical situation of a much bigger street where it works fine. I guess I can't do it. I'm running out of parking. I've got more space. We could tar over the grass, but then there's a regulation that you have to have a certain percentage of green space, so you can't do that. Green space I'm kind of concerned about is the green space in the cash register, though, because, and it's not just business, like if I make more money, I get to buy a nicer car, but when I have more business, I can hire more people to sell more goods. I already have 200 vendors. They produce goods, and they hire people, and they transport them to me, and the whole thing goes around really nicely. So there I sit with empty chairs. There's a street full of people that can't get to me. We can't seem to trade. And green space isn't actually green. Like, don't think necessarily like chlorophyll and photosynthesis and the like. I have a cement patio where we have outdoor dining. If you jackhammer up the cement and replace it with bricks, that is, if you jackhammer up cement and trade them in for bricks, for every square foot of bricks, I can tar over some grass and park a car on it. Must make sense to somebody, but I'm kind of confused. Sales tax. In order for me to get a liquor license, I have to go through financial statements. I need to have proof of workers' comp insurance. I have to have proof of liquor liability insurance. I have to disclose who the landlord is and any other building owners and all the other partners in my business. I have to give the building info with a diagram and scale drawings of where the liquor is going to be served and all that. I have to prove that I paid the utilities. I need approval from the city, the county, the state, building and safety, fire department, and have a background check done on me. Right. Then I can get a liquor license. After I get a liquor license, I get a state buyer's card, which is another little $20 bonus that I get to pay for. One of my liquor distributors was being audited by the sales tax department. They did not have an ST3 form on me, which is a state form that says I have a sales tax number. So they could not sell me liquor. Now, in order to have an ST3 form, you need a sales tax number. This company that sells to me, by law, can only sell to licensed dealers. That's it. It's not like Best Buy where anybody can walk in the door. This is a company that can only sell to licensed dealers. I am a licensed dealer, but since we didn't have that form on file proving I had a sales tax number, I couldn't buy liquor. We did get it figured out, but of course there's some glitches in the way. On that liquor buyer's card, too, back during the government shutdown, there were several different restaurants and liquor stores and all that their liquor buyer's card expired. I think Miller Beer was even one of them. They didn't have a liquor buyer's card or some other thing. And they're done. They're out of business. And it just, I didn't happen to me because apparently I bought mine at the right time of the year that I kind of avoided that mess. But here are companies, here are businesses that are, you know, they're in business, they're doing a good job, they're not selling stuff to minors, they're not putting lead in the paint from China, they're selling an honest product in an honest way, and they can't because of some bureaucratic technicality somewhere completely out of their control, and they're out of business. On the topic of sales tax, too, you could get a master's degree in sales taxology. I mean, this thing here is just amazing. Honey is not taxable. Nuts are not taxable. Sugar is not taxable. But if you put honey or sugar on the nuts, then it's taxable. That's only if I do it. Now, it's not even a health issue because you could buy a 5-pound bag of sugar and go home and sit in front of the TV and eat it all, and that's fine. You could even have a bowl of pecans with it, and that's fine. You could put the sugar on the pecans, but I can't do it. Otherwise, it has to be sales tax. candy bars are taxable, but not if they have flour in them, like a Twix bar, for instance, which is specifically mentioned in the regulations. Frozen candy bars are not taxed either, but only if they require to be frozen. So if you throw a Snickers bar in the freezer, you still have to tax it. But if it's something like ice cream, even ice cream with nuts and sugar and honey in it, like an ice cream bar, then that is not subject to sales tax.
Mr. Zubeck, excuse me. I can't wait to take you to tax committee with me. I want you to catch your breath, and I appreciate just the perspective that you're bringing to this discussion, because we're probably going to get kind of bogged down again in the legalese and the bureaucratic for a little bit. But hang with us. I need to call up two other testifiers,
okay.
And I'm watching the clock. Was there any kind of concluding remarks you wanted to make at this point, or again, I'd be happy to call you up again.
Well, just
Mr.
Zubin. Over 40 years, I could put together quite a list. it's suffocating. It's stifling. I feel like my main job is to navigate through this government minefield out there and try to figure out how to grow and thrive while in the face of that. I don't, really look for handouts or bailouts or anything. I just wish everybody just get out of my way and let me do my job.
Well, I appreciate that, and that is absolutely the intent of what this committee wants to do and what Senator Lilly is trying to do. I know I've got at least two members who want to. Do you want to say something to Mr. Zubay, Senator Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's two items that I thought were so revealing, that the committee perhaps should know about, if they can be. If we have just a couple minutes, one had to do with I think the rule and reg about the sign and the light fixture
light
and the cage
cover.
And the switch and where it was. This is just kind of an example of rules and regs maybe gone awry. And the second, very briefly, is the filing for the sales tax or turning in your sales tax.
That's a lengthy story, but the light switch.
Well, let's do the short one then.
Thank you. In one of our restaurants, we had a light switch that was 12 feet in the air that controlled the front sign, and when His Majesty came through for our final inspection, he required us to put a cage around, a locking cage. And usually the answers, when you ask the question, always start with what if, and in his case it was what if somebody is out front working on the sign, and what if somebody inside flips on the light switch and they get electrocuted. This light switch is 12 feet in the air, but I hire a master electrician to hop in his pickup truck, run to the parts store, come back, grab a ladder, go up there, and put a locking cage around my light switch 12 feet in the air because it's a safety issue.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Zubay, my 17-year-old is going to be washing dishes pretty soon, and so I'm going to tell him to Google you so that he can aspire to be where you are now, because he's frustrated. He's going to make $7 an hour. So looking forward to that, and congratulations. I get so inspired when I hear stories like yours. But I want to say something that I believe is the truth, and you will see this pretty soon. This legislation that we're moving forward will not change what you're describing today. I am sorry.
It's a start.
And I have to tell you the truth, because I think we're saying that we will change that. We will not change that for multiple reasons. One, because a lot of these issues that you're talking about are related to licensing processes that are not put forward by us. They are city, and you have to work with your city council. Some of them are related to policies that are in place. But this bill does not intend to look into those processes and correct them. This bill says during 2 years, we're not going to do more of it, right? We're not going to create more rules that are complicated, which is not bad. For 2 years, we're not going to keep adding to your pain. And I'm sure you appreciate that, and I think that's but I want to make absolutely sure that you know that this bill does not correct any of the problems. What would correct the problems that you're describing is that we have that list that you're describing, and we review that and go one by one and figure out where, you know, where is the problem? How do these agencies came about? How do these regulations, whether they are local, state, came about? And then go one by one and review them and just delete them if they are obsolete or change them. This bill does not do that. And I think my comment earlier is about that, right? It's about the fundamental issue behind it. What are we really changing? If we say for 2 years we don't do any more damage, it's not bad, and I'm not opposed to this. But I just want you to know we're not correcting the problems that you are describing.
All right, members, I want to
very quickly, Mr. Chairman.
I'll get to you very quickly after we bring up two other people. He's still going to be here. He's still going to be here, Senator Thomas. You're next. Could I get Bob Meyer and Kent, Commissioner Peterson, to come up to the table? I've got four members who've all promised me they're going to keep it short. I'm not sure I believe you, but I'll try.
Sure, I have a couple. Just one hand on it, I can pass it over.
And the staff can help with that. Senator,
did you have one?
Thank you for joining us, gentlemen. Hang on a sec. Senator DeCryf.
Well, actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I had a question for Mr. Zubwe.
Well, do you want to hold that then?
I'd like to hold that
for
you.
He left.
It was actually a question. Okay.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick to Senator Torres Ray's point, she's absolutely correct. This bill does not do anything to address those problems, but Senator Daley's bill that we had in committee last week does help address some of those issues with the regulations, and that's why that bill is so important. And I'll just add one more thing to what Senator Torres Ray said. It will not affect any of those issues that he's currently dealing with, but hopefully it'll put a timeout, as the chair says, on adding to that list. So I think it's...
Mr. Chairman, why did Senator Miller get to say that and I didn't?
Were you going to say that, Senator
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
Because it's Senator Miller...
I'm glad that...
Senator Thompson, the answer is because it's his birthday today.
That's good enough.
Uh-oh. It's Senator Miller's birthday.
And members know I'm not 30 yet. It's 29.
Mr. Chairman, let me add the one thing to that, because I don't know if we can change the problems that that Mr. Zubé just brought up. But I think what people have to do when they come in and tell us about these problems is also give us suggestions on how to change the problem, because a lot of what he was talking about is electrical safety, about health safety and things which have been put in law and in rule for a reason. But if there's things that need to be changed, I think at Senator Daley's commission, they have to come in with suggestions on what should be changed.
It's a great point, Senator Thomsonian. Another thought would be, well, we can only control what we can control here at the state level, but wouldn't it be great if some of these local levels of government followed the lead and they had a timeout? That would really impact some of the things that Mr. Zubé was talking about. The other thing I'll just note for the record, members, is that we're not doing this or contemplating this in isolation. Actually, four other governors, by executive order, have put into place some kind of moratorium on rulemaking. So, Arizona, Washington, North Carolina, New Jersey, this is, I wish I could say it's landmark, brand new, never been thought of before, but it's indeed it's not. And even the CEOs of various states are moving on their own. So, with that, I'm going to recognize Mr. Meyer first.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here in the Jobs Committee. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources, and I usually spend my time in the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. However, I have been asked by the administration just to make some brief comments about the administration position on rulemaking authority. And to do that, I did hand out a copy of a veto letter that was sent April 14th by Governor Dayton last session, and also a copy of a letter sent by Governor Dayton back in 2003. While these letters address legislative approval of rules, they do also talk about the concept of usurping the executive branch authority for rulemaking. And just in the effort of time, Mr. Chairman, on the first page of the Governor Dayton letter, right after the three stars, I want to just read that sentence. Currently, the legislature has the authority to change or amend an existing rule through legislation. Existing law, which allows the legislature to essentially override any rule passed by an agency, would seem to provide ample protections against overly burdensome or unnecessary rules. And then in closing, in Governor Dayton's letter, the last sentence says, I will strongly safeguard the long-established principles of executive agency rulemaking and regulatory authority. So those are kind of the sideboards we're looking at this with. It's been a great discussion so far. Just one comment from the Department of Natural Resources. The bill as currently drafted would prohibit any hunting or fishing seasons for the next 2 years because we do establish those rules and those quotas and dates by rule, specific rulemaking authority we have in Chapter 97. So the negative millions and billions of dollars created by that economic stimulus would be impacted under this bill.
Well, Mr. Meyer, to that immediately, I'm certain that that's not Senator Lilly's intent. I don't know if that is your read from the A2 or from the bill as originally introduced, but Senator Lilly, did you have a quick reaction to that?
Actually, if I could ask counsel to address specifically where that is in here, where that exception is. I believe that the judge did refer to that earlier in Senator Tomasoni's question. Number three, I believe it was.
Oh, well, Mr. Chair, members, and I think under the paragraph 3 on line 1.14, again, the Environment and Natural Resources Committee could certainly say that the Department of Natural Resources shall, commence or conduct rulemaking regarding, game and fish seasons. But also, I believe there could be another exemption that's in Chapter 14. And I'm not sure if Mr. Meyer, if this would help, that is regarding, I don't know if it's in Chapter 14, not under expedited rulemaking, but I guess I just would point to paragraph 3, and if the DNR wanted to specifically come to the legislative committees to authorize during this temporary moratorium to
Mr. Meyer, please continue. I just thought that was a significant enough issue.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. The way I read number 3, relating to incorporation of specific changes set forth in statute, if, for example, a statute would change a specific piece of a rule, then we would have the ability to go back and amend that rule, much as a good cause exemption is. So while I think you're talking about the concept that we need or that you need to look at expanding current existing rulemaking authority that exists, now you're prohibiting that. So we have a ton of issues. I'm not here to talk about the natural resources issues, though, Mr. Chair. Just a couple other quick comments. Senator Torres-Ray, while this would stop bad rules, it will also prohibit good rules from being implemented as well. Currently, Governor Dayton has empowered his cabinet to undertake a continuous improvement process looking at every piece of agency operations and improve those for job creation, to meet the current demands of the system, to make things better. This language is going to stop that from happening. So while we want to, and Governor Dayton and the administration recognizes job creation as number one, I think you hear him say that all the time, this bill, a rulemaking moratorium, will have some serious impacts on that. So we need to try to figure out how can we do this. As we worked last year on environmental review, regulatory reform, and we're continuing to do it this year, shutting down the rulemaking process will probably stop a lot of that as well. So we need to take that into consideration.
And again, Mr. Meyer, that very topic was the subject of a lot of discussion at this table over the last hour. And again, it is not the intent to stop what we'd call, job-creating rules. That's absolutely something that's positive and something that we want to do. So there may be either a difference of opinion or interpretation, and certainly need to continue to work together. So,
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate
that. Please continue with your testimony.
On that note, the bill as drafted, I believe, and the executive branch believes, will have impacts on all rulemaking, good and bad. So we will need to try to work on that. And rulemaking authority is something that we need to maintain within the executive branch to make things better. Thank you.
And Mr. Meyer, thank you. So you're not saying the governor would intend to veto this bill?
Mr. Chair, I've not had any discussions on that. All I'm saying is that going back to his comments back in April of last year, that he will strongly safeguard the executive branch rulemaking authority.
Don't need us.
Commissioner Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ken Peterson, Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for allowing me to testify for you. I'm going to just talk a little bit how it affects how our department approaches rulemaking, some of the issues we deal with, and some of the considerations, how we do it, some of the mechanics of actually how we do it. But before I do that, I want to tell Mr. Zube, wherever he is, to talk to me afterwards, because we are looking at our electrical code, and maybe we can do something about that light switch. I'm not sure we can, but we're always looking at that, and if we can do something with it, I'd like to do it. And I'm not sure we can, but...
Say that again, Commissioner Peterson. Just walked in the door.
My department oversees the electrical inspectors, and my name's Ken Peterson, and please talk to me afterwards, and we'll see what we can do.
Well done.
And I'm not sure we can, but we're going to try. At least from his telling of the situation, it sounds a little absurd. And so we'll take a look at it and see if we can do something. A couple things I want to really make clear, though, is that all the rulemaking that at least we do in this department, and I was commissioner before and I was with the AG's office, too, and most of the rulemaking I've seen is always done based on instructions from the legislature. They're very specific, saying you do rules to carry out the intent of this chapter or intent of this clause. And we don't do policy. I interviewed someone when I first took over this job. I interviewed a person who I didn't hire to be an assistant commissioner or deputy commissioner or something. And she said the reason she wanted the job was because she wanted to do policy. And I said, well, the wrong place. You got to go run the legislature. They do policy. We don't do that. We implement policy. That's what the executive branch does. And I recognize that sometimes that's in the eyes of the beholder. But generally, we really try, and I think, at least I know, I really try to not to overstep our bounds. We believe that we have a place in the governance system, and the legislature has a place. We do not want to get into the policy-making grounds. We do not want to do that. We do want to carry out the authorization of the legislature. So that's one thing. And so I don't think you ought to overreact and think that that executive agencies are going overboard in enacting policy. I don't think they are. And second, as Mr. Myers pointed out, anytime you want to repeal a rule, just do it. If we're sending a bunch in our housekeeping bill, repealing a bunch of our rules, and we also do it by rulemaking, too. We do try to clean ours out. And then we update them as we can. And I hope other agencies do the same. I actually prepared some of the world's finest testimony ever made in preparation for dealing with the exemptions as laid out in the original bill. Now, they've changed, so I'm going to jump around a little bit and not be as well organized.
It's all taken care of, Commissioner Peters.
A couple different situations where we do rules. We do rules mostly in our Workers' Comp Division and the Construction Code and Licensing Division. First, the Workers' Comp. One area we do is every year we update the medical fee schedule. That just sets the prices for workers' compensation medical costs. And it covers about 800 procedures and different items. 8,000, I'm sorry, about 8,000 of them. And we combine the Medicare prices with the statewide average weekly wage, and we come up with a number, and we allow the increase to go through. Generally, it's around 2 or 3%. It's done for, and I think that would be covered under exception number 4, relating to changes do not alter the sense, meaning, or effect of a rule. I think, I want to be clear, that doing stuff like that would do it, because if we don't do it, it affects the medical community. They do not get their cost increase that they deserve. So I want to make clear, I hope that's covered by that. Because then we're not actually facilitating commerce. We're not helping out people. We're hurting them. At the same time, maybe this is always where the conundrum is, that if we don't do that changes next year, it may help some workers' comp premium ratepayers. Maybe their rates won't go up quite so much. So we have a conundrum there. But at the same time, I think the legislature has instructed us to raise it when we do, and I think the chapter, that clause 4 allows it. So as long as I'm clear with that, I want to make sure that we get some of this stuff on the record in case we ever get a trial or an appellate case where we're looking at the legislative record and want to find out where we're going. My second area is on the construction code licensing. We administer the building codes. There was some discussion earlier on that. I wasn't in the room. I had to go and get a drink of water. But right now, we're in the process of redoing the state building code. It hasn't been done since 2006. And this is It's composed of about 23 volumes. This is volume one. And so it's a big thing. It's an item you guys do not want to deal with. It does get into specifics that I don't think is well, that the legislature really wants to spend its time on, it's like window glazing, that sort of thing. I don't think you want to get into that. But I want to make clear that we could, if under this statute, that we could go ahead with it. The way it's set up now, the department is authorized, is instructed to have a building code. We do have a building code. And then the statute says, and I don't have the specific statute number, it says we may periodically update it. We do it, usually it's done on a three-year basis, but it was not done in 2009 for lack of funds. So now it's been 6 years since we've been updated, and we've started, embarked on a process that I think is a pretty good process. Judge Lippman said that these rulemaking things are very closed. They're really not. In this case, we've got well over 150 volunteers manning 10 different committees. They're experts in the areas looking at the various parts of the building codes. And then we have, I suppose, about 100 other people that just come to every meeting and discuss it, look at it, going through the various provisions of the code and making sure that it fits Minnesota. If they don't fit Minnesota, then they come up with recommended changes. They try to arrive at them by a consensus. In 2006, we were able to do it by the consensus. We did not have to have a contested hearing. We hope we'll do the same thing this year. So it does involves a lot of people, and hopefully those people go back to their respective organizations, like the architects go back to the Architects Association, the builders go back to the Building Association, and they talk about what needs to be done. So I think in that sense, it's a very transparent, a very open process, and a very necessary process. And I think it also facilitates commerce. I think it helps helps our builders know what makes them consistent with other states, makes them consistent with other countries. So the states around us all have adopted new building codes. We haven't. So I think if we weren't able to adopt it or put it off for two more years, I think it would be a detriment to our, to business in Minnesota. I don't say it's not going to stop things in its tracks or anything like that. I don't want to overemphasize it. However, it would, I think, be a detriment. So I do want to make clear that in your mind, this would be covered, this sort of thing would be covered. And there are a lot of rulemaking provisions that do say may do. You may do the rules as you want to do them. It doesn't say you have to do them. And that's, I think, is going to be a difficult situation for agencies and for judges and for the public to determine whether or not that falls under the exemption number three. I think it's three. And with that, that concludes my remarks. I just want to say, rulemaking is complicated. I don't think the executive agencies overstepped their bounds. If they are, you should crack down on them. Someone should hit them, and they shouldn't do it. I hope my agency doesn't. I don't want it to ever happen. And if you ever see this happening to us, please let me know. Thank you very much.
Commissioner Peterson. I want to give Senator Lilly an opportunity for some concluding remarks. We've had some good testimony, Senator Lilly, and I think you see and have heard some of the issues that you're going to have to deal with moving forward, particularly in the State Government Committee. So, Senator Lilly.
Yes. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you, and testifiers, thank you so much for your feedback and testifying today. You know, Minnesota businesses basically play by the rules. They want to play by the rules. They want to follow what we set up as agencies, as the legislature, but their main focus is running their business, running their jobs. And that's where they really want to be. And to do that, they need timely and predictable structure. They need to know what the rules are that they're working under. And we do think that government can be a little more proactive in being more customer-focused in helping these businesses create more jobs in Minnesota. So this approach places many of our businesses at an unreasonable disadvantage with their competitors across the state, across the other states, and across the world. So what we want to do is create a consistency in rulemaking that offers stability to these businesses, freeing them up to focus and maintain more on creating jobs. That's what we're really focusing on. Now, we will be talking more about this in state government and get more into the rulemaking process at that point, but I would really like to ask for the committee's vote and support on this bill.
Thank you, sure. Senator Lilly. So Senator Miller, in honor of his birthday, moves the Senate File 1631 as amended. Be recommended to pass, and referred to the State and Government Committee.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Kulash on the motion.
I think some issues were brought up, and I just would appreciate it if we could ask the judge to come back and comment on the May versus Shell kind of language that Commissioner
Senator
Peterson
Kulash,
brought up.
We're starting to lose the room here because it's after 10, but
Are we all done with testimony already?
Can address the Senator Kulash's issue.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kulash, would you refresh my recollection as to May versus Shell? I'd be glad to be helpful if I can.
Commissioner testified that the legislature has given the department permission to may change rules as necessary, and that's not the same as saying shall change or that, you know, so under this statute, would they be allowed to update their construction codes? Would they be allowed to update their medical fee schedule? I mean, and this is just one department, obviously.
Sure.
We have a lot of mays and a lot of different agencies and departments.
Mr. Chairman, that's Senator Kulash, it's my understanding that the building code, I was looking at our record of opinions, which is online, and in 2006, which was the last one that I saw that the building code amendments, that was done by way of regular rulemaking. That would be paused under the A2 amendment, except if the legislature, as the commissioner suggests, were to take the binder and say, these are the pieces of the building code we'd like to enact.
So, Mr. Chair, just to follow up. So if the statute says may change those rules, this would negate that for any future rulemaking.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kulash, as I understand the A2 amendment, there would be a pause, notwithstanding the fact that in earlier statutes, there have been a delegation of rulemaking authority for the convenience of good and sound buildings. Mm-hmm. Commissioner Peterson is to promulgate the code on building standards. That would be a pause, except if we were to have one of these good cause exemptions. Does that make sense?
I'm getting a little confused because when you said that the legislature can give the department by policy the authority to make rules, right? So, in fact, we have done that and said the Department of Labor and Industry may change the rules on building codes, as they see fit, right? So what you're saying is that is no longer valid? What specific language would we have to have? Would we have to do legislation for every single agency that has a May rule and say you shall do this change or from here on forward if this were to pass?
And Mr. Lipman, this is a two-year timeout.
I understand, but
just
still.
Finish, Mr. Kulash. Yeah. So just a two-year moratorium. Then if we, the legislature, wanted any specific department to move within that two-year band, that would be up to us.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kulash, yes.
Okay. On the motion, on the Miller motion, on Senate File 1631, recommend to pass and refer to state government. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Nay. The motion is passed. Thank you, Senator Lilly. Thank you, members. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Adjourned. Thank you.